This is the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast, a podcast about technology, history, and stories. Thanks to Jeff Atwood, Dan Boyd, and the hundreds of other Patreon supporters who help make this podcast possible. I can't remember where or how I exactly met Andy. It must have been on a bulletin board system. That's how I met a lot of people. You'd call up, leave some messages, somebody would have something to say, and inevitably you'd learn that you live near each other and maybe would talk about meeting up. And Andy and I were two not exactly different people, but we were definitely on different paths. I was about 16 years old, Andy was in his early 20s, and we had both gone to the same high school. In fact, as we soon learned, my phone number at the house I'd moved into was the phone number of his parents' old house. His parents had long ago moved and retired, gone off to the Cayman Islands, and Andy had a place of his own in Mount Kisco. And one of the things that really linked us up was that Andy loved toys. In high school, he'd played with robots, you know, robots of a much less complicated nature than now, but still putting together robots in high school. And what blew me away when we met was he had a CD player in his car. It doesn't sound like much, but in 1987, CDs were just coming into the general populace, and Andy not only had a CD player in his car, which itself was a really nice Firebird, it had a 12 CD changer. In 1987, I can't even begin to explain how space age this technology was. It'd be like finding out now that somebody had launched and was maintaining his own small private satellite. We'd drive around and talk about stuff and go out to eat, and he'd be able to play from a variety of interesting CDs, including Yellow, one of my favorite bands, who had the distinction of being one of the first digitally recorded pop bands. They used to have a little indication on CDs to indicate the source, the mastering, and the final printing, and it would say ADD, meaning analog, digital, digital, but all of the Yellow albums were digital, digital, digital. Andy had given me his old record collection. It was Black Flag and Kraftwerk and an eclectic mix of music. It was different than mine, but the same. It gets deeper, though. I've looked back, and I'm kind of interested in how friendships happen, especially friendships that occur because of technology. You know, you have something that you like, perhaps ham radio, or soldering, or creating interesting little devices and gadgets, and you meet somebody somehow, to which that's the reason you both know each other. You know, entertainment products, books, something that really brings the two of you into a circle, an orbit of conversation, such that you are both kind of bringing to the table a half of a conversation that the two of you may have for a short time, for just one event, or maybe for a lifetime. Andy and I both enjoyed toys, but Andy loved toys, and he could afford really nice ones. He'd have a bunch of interesting computers over at his apartment, which used to be owned by his parents, and they'd moved away, but now he had filled up all the floors with computer parts and servers and keyboards and all the spare parts of somebody who loved to tinker. He'd bring me over, this teenage friend, and we'd talk about what was there, and he'd walk me through what he had found from friends and colleagues. He had a job at Zeiss Corporation, the makers of lenses, and I remember visiting him there once. I don't even know how I got there. It's almost like a dream. But I do remember that he showed me that he was working on some sort of vision system. The idea was that there would be a bucket of parts, and the vision system could reach into the bucket and figure out what every item in there was by looking at it. This was pure black magic to me. I couldn't begin to understand what he was programming or how he was bringing it apart, but apparently Zeiss Corporation thought this was a good idea. Andy didn't eat stuff, we'd communicate online. And every time Andy went into something, he went in big. He worked on a bulletin board system called Spies on the Wire. This may have even been the place I met him. And while most people would have been content at the time to have a single computer hooked up to a single phone line via a single modem, Andy had eight. And they were hooked up to a Xenix system that was capable of running a multi-user interaction and chatting, and people could call in through one of eight phone lines he'd set up in his apartment. I mean, again, this is all mid-1980s that he's screwing around with a system that must have cost thousands of dollars and maintained these phone lines, eight of them, and never charged a cent. It was all about tinkering and playing with toys. So on Spies on the Wire, I talked with Andy about ideas and dreams and things we might work on. And somewhere in there, we started to concoct the idea of making a multi-user adventure game. I mean, I did love adventure games. And it would be neat, wouldn't it, if you created some sort of adventure game that took place somewhere, and as time went on, you would discover other people were playing other parts of the adventure game. Now, the way that we came up with the final idea that we ultimately didn't act on was it was actually going to turn out that spoiler alert, it was going to turn out to be a brain, a mind, you know, a person who was thinking, and you were inside that person's mind. And so the places that you were working on in this adventure game were portions of their memories and portions of their story. And then over time, you would conjunct with other open areas in the Spies on the Wire, and then you would ultimately realize you were inside a mind. We didn't get far in terms of finishing it, and I don't know how much writing I actually did for it. But it was a theme that Andy and I had for years afterwards. He'd think of an idea. He'd think of some interesting variation on what was out there, try to extend it to a much greater extent, and then I would sometimes be brought in to possibly write copy or do some drawing or in some way help him with it. I mean, I never felt taken advantage of. Never once. Never now. Never looking back. Andy was just somebody who I just got along with him, you know? He was very friendly to me. And I'd see him maybe once every few weeks during my teens. It was one of those friendships where he was busy. He had things to do. He was starting to rise in the world and making contacts and becoming an engineer in every sense of the word. And, you know, he would invite his wide-eyed friend over and we'd talk about stuff. And he'd always have something sitting around. And I would ask what it was. And he would tell me. And I would realize I'd never hoped I would ever run into this. Andy was one of the people who not only introduced me to the Amiga, he also lent me one. You know, he had one from a job he was doing, and they had finished doing the portion that the Amiga would do, and it was lying around. And he said, hey, do you want to borrow it for a while? And this was a dream come true for me. It was an Amiga 500. It had all of these interesting 3.5-inch floppies, and I set it up in one of the rooms of my father's house, and I learned about the Amiga's graphics and sound and being able to play these demos that were out there in the world, you know, these really fun music and sound creations that people primarily in Europe were creating. It was a tool and an adventure and a doorway all in one. And my love of the Amiga comes through when you hear me talk about it in the Viva Amiga documentary that came out this year. I was recorded for that 7 years ago, but everything I said in there still applies. You know, it's this beautiful creation, this toy and this tool. And Andy loved introducing me to those. One time I was visiting him in one of his apartments. He'd moved several times, and it was in Ossining. Now, Ossining, New York, if you don't know where that is along the banks of the Hudson River. And what it's mostly known for to most of the world is the Sing Sing Penitentiary, a jail that is along the Hudson River. And Andy was living in an apartment that overlooked Sing Sing Prison. What this meant was that if you went out on his deck during the day, all you could hear was the prison yard, just men shouting at each other and playing basketball and yelling, and it was just this horrifying cacophony of anger that was bubbling up from these barbed wire pits that you overlooked in your pleasant apartment. And Andy did what I think some people may or may not have thought was a good idea, and he would occasionally set up speakers on the deck and blast jailhouse rock down at the furious prisoners. He was a guy who did stuff that made me laugh. So visiting him in this apartment, I saw that he had a whole bunch of servers lying around. And what he explained to me was that he had carefully acquired and borrowed all sorts of high-capacity storage devices. You know, we're talking 10 megabyte, 20 megabyte being unbelievably expensive. And Andy had borrowed 250 megabyte drives, massive affairs that were the size of a small refrigerator. And he had brought in a bunch of them so that he could say, with no doubt, that he had a gigabyte of storage in his apartment in 1988. He also had a Pixar computer. I don't know how many people know that Pixar originally had a computer for graphics rendering, and that was their product, and they moved into movies only as a way to demonstrate the power of that computer. And over time, they decided that the hardware business was not for them, and they took the software that they made called RenderMan, they made that available as a commercial product, and then ultimately, Pixar basically created movies until now. But there we are, thanks to Andy, I have a memory of a Pixar computer, and touching it and seeing how weird and amazing these computers could be. You know, when he got the gigabyte of space in his apartment, that was the end of the story. Andy didn't have a plan for the gigabyte. It was just to do it, just to say he'd done it, just the pride at trying something weird and cobbling it together and for one shining moment saying that you have it before it all falls apart. I kind of internalize this. I always love making a point or bringing things together or assembling something, fully aware it'll, you know, never have a full, meaningful use. But isn't it great and neat and fun that we did it? Andy moved from Zeiss to working for a few other companies, and came the day that he got a job offer at Apple. And now this was going to take him away. He was going to leave New York, where we both lived, and he was going to move away to California, a place I'd always dreamed I could be. And they were going to pay for his transport, which was amazing to me, and they were going to put him in charge of analyzing new products, and he was excited. But as he, you know, packed up his place, moved away, I knew in some ways that that was the end of us hanging out together in any meaningful way. Through the 90s, I had all sorts of communication with Andy in terms of an occasional phone call or an email. At one point, he hosted some items of mine, and it was a game and some Unix accounts, and this was at a time when, again, it was prohibitively expensive to have much like that, and Andy was just providing it. And one day, the machine stopped working. I'd had his contact info to ask him to put things back up again when they inevitably fell down, and he'd do it over the course of a day or two. But one day, the machine went down, and I remember I was something like 22 or 23 now, and I started leaving a bunch of messages saying, "Where's the machine, Andy? Andy, I really need this thing back up again." And one day, my fax machine went off at work, and on the fax machine was a smiley face. And the smiley face under it said, "Eat a rock, Jason." It was Andy saying, "Yeah, I'm not going to get that machine back up for you, man." We stayed friends, though. The kind of friendship that you bond over technology means you know things snap off, they end, they reboot, they recharge. You know, you go back to your buddy maybe a few months later or a few years later. It depends on what's going on. Andy's star, however, continued to rise. He started working for all manner of Silicon Valley companies, either through his Apple contacts or just simply from meeting people. And he was always tinkering. So one day he registered the .tv domain, which is the domain for the island of Tuvalu. He told me the way he did this was they found out that the island of Tuvalu at the time had about 6 phone lines, and he called up their government and was transferred back and forth to eventually the Minister of Agriculture and Technology, who it turned out could sort of sign off on the domain. So he registered the .tv domain. He didn't do anything with it, but he did own it. And once you've got one top-level domain, why stop? He had the .ky domain for a while, the domain for the Cayman Islands, the reason being that his parents, who had retired to the Cayman Islands, needed email, and he wanted to send them email at their home country. And maybe this is all the insight into his personality you need to know. One of the requirements when you registered a top-level domain, and I'm talking about a country domain, was that you needed to have a machine inside of the domain and a machine named outside of the domain. So the outside machine was wiretap.spies.com, and the internal machine was alt.sex.ky. Nobody was happy about this, but nobody could say no. So for a while, alt.sex.ky was the domain register for the Cayman Islands. That's Andy for you. We each went on our journeys. I traveled to Boston, became a game maker, an ISP worker, a Unix admin. Andy stayed in California. He worked in all sorts of technology jobs. He became more of a manager. He got married. He had kids. I got married. I didn't have kids. We talked, but only in the lightest of manner. I mean, Andy was busy. He was super busy. He was playing with toys, and he was playing with his family. You know, it wasn't going to be a case of being able to chat with him for very long, but I treasured the time that we had together. I remember every once in a while, I'd find out he'd registered some crazy domain. You know, he was able to register really short name domains, and then he'd put some toy on it. He registered the word danger. He put his car on the internet and made it that it was live streaming pictures. He was sending photos of what was outside the front windshield and what was outside the back, along with some mapping software that would guess as to the exact location of the car and also print that, all of it on a static web page. This is pre-2000. His curiosity knew no bounds. So as we get here to the end of 2017 and the first year of this podcast, I really want people who listen to this to understand that the nature of friendship, especially in a technology realm, is extremely fluid and full of all sorts of ups and downs, and that when you look back on a friendship that goes across decades, you remember the good times. You remember the really great moments you had together. And when things inevitably fade out because people move to different areas or different places in lives, whether in geography or ideology or what they want to do with their lives, you hold close what you had before. That does not change. It only fades. And for me, I'll always treasure those moments that I had with a really brilliant guy who put things together in ways I could have never imagined and encouraged me to remix, take risks, try new stuff, and whose idea at danger.com became a phone that he sold and became known as the Danger Hip Top and later the T-Mobile Hip Top, and which led him to work again on phones because that technology fascinated him, and who, when he needed to name his next company, named it after his nickname in high school because he loved robots so much. Android. And that is the story of my friendship with Andy Android, Ruben. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to Astrid Smith, Sam Johnston, Stefan Arendts, and James Bakoyanu, along with the hundreds of other supporters who have made this podcast what it is. The main page for the podcast is podcast.textfiles.com, T-E-X-T-F-I-L-E-S. Support for this podcast via Patreon, PayPal, and other platforms have allowed me to pay off an enormous amount of bills and debt, and it will continue to make my life easier. So thank you so much to everyone, and talk to you next week.